Hi, everybody, friends of more, friends of management of reality. Good to be back with you again. Today, we have a very interesting, I believe the title. Hi, Yoel, forgive me. I always forget. How are you doing, Yoel?
Hello, everyone. Fine. And you, Francisco?
Yeah. Hey, I think the title we gave to today's talk, to today's podcast is, did the take something from the Arab Palestinians, right?
Yes.
That's the title, right? So this is, we're going to be talking about this question because there's something that I call the Arab narrative. Okay, so the Arab, basically, the design went over there, you know, to the Middle East from Europe to steal the land of the Arab Palestinians and then to oppress. This is sort of the narrative. All of the press made against Israel to make concessions to the Arab Palestinians, regardless, right? So that no matter how violent the Arab Palestinians become, the gives you this historical argument that says, well, but they were the victims of an original injustice, and on the basis of claim of an original injustice, then anything. Because it's a fight for liberation, okay? So that's that would be the most extreme version of the Arab narrative. There are weaker ones. No, terrorism is bad, but okay, so terrorism bad, but we still have to give them a state and blah, blah, blah. But that, right? Okay. Now, you're very young. How old are you?
I'm 22.
Okay, so you're 22. Now, this means that you never had a chance to see how the narrative on Israel changed dramatically in the 70s. Okay, so before the 1970s, Israel was the darling of the international left. You know, because for all the obvious reasons, because they had been the victims of the Nazis, who were the extreme right, you know. So from that point of view, the left had to say, well, we're anti be pro-Jew, right? That the Holocaust was very recent, right? We're talking about the first few decades after the Second World War. So the memory of the Holocaust is still fresh. The memory of the Nazis is fresh. So if you're a leftist, for pro-Jew. So that's one reason. Another reason is that the Zionist movement was quasi-Marxist. These huge unions tied to the state in a very corporatist, left corporatist kind of design. And the state owns everything. I mean, to this day, 93% of the land is state-owned land. There's almost no private land in Israel, right? And then you had these collectivist farms that were the only state-sponsored collectivist effort that I know of, where the collectivism actually any core everywhere else people had and threatened, collectivized, but not in Israel, right? So you got this quasi-Marxist Zionists, who were these quasi-Marxist leftists. They were the dominant movement within Zionism, right? So that was another reason in the immediate post-war for the international left to say, hey, we like what we see. The Zionist Jews, yeah, bravo. Was that in the immediate, what happened was that the United Nations, and this is also something that young people don't know. So the picture that people have in their heads, the picture is that the United States somehow went into the Middle East to create the state of Israel to disadvantage the Arabs. This is what I keep hearing people. Well, but the U.S. Israel. No, that's not what happened. The made a proposal to create two states, not one state, not a Jewish state. The proposal was to create two states, a two-state solution, yes, one for the Arabs and one for the Jews, right? The young people don't know this anymore. They think the Western colonialists went in there to create two states. And the Arabs to be created on the very that the Arab and the Arab states more generally have to be the lands for a Palestinian state. It was going to be created on those lands. That's what the UN offered in 1940s and a little bit more. That's what the UN offered in 1947, okay, for the Arabs. And then also a state for the Jews. It was a two-state solution. But the representatives of the Arab-Palestinians said no. The leaders of the Arab states also said no. No, 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 we don't want an Arab-Palestinian state. It means that the Jews are going to get... They were very explicit. They said, we don't accept this. So they rejected Arab-Palestinian state. And Hazan Pasha, Secretary General, announced in public that there would be a war of extermination. And they kept their promise. So Muslims from all over the world joined. Let me tell you how many. I'll tell you the countries that attacked Israel in 1948. So this was Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon. No, no, forgive me. That's the 67 war. It was Egypt, Jordan, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, and Yemen. And in addition to these countries, you had several irregular armies, you know, of Muslims from different places joining together to form these irregular armies. All of that together, the invading forces were fully equipped with the standard weapons of a regular army. So they had artillery, tanks, armored cars, personnel carriers, machine guns, mortars, usual, full supply, oil, gasoline. And moreover, Egypt, Iraq, and Syria had air forces. In contrast, the Jews had no matching artillery, no tanks, and no warplanes in the first days of the war. So, electrical kind of combat. And it was a real miracle that the Israeli Jews, it's unbelievable. So this is the class versus Goliath, right?
Yes.
There's another reason for the international left to support the Zionists. The people attacking the Jews were bullies at once, announcing that they're going to collide with professional armies, which the Israeli Jews did not have. You know, so all of that constructs a David versus Goliath story, plus that the Arab, I mean, they were very close to the extreme of Europe in terms of the systems that they, and they had been allied with the Nazis during, for all of these reasons, the Zionists of the international left. This is very hard for people today to imagine, because the Western left has become the main political vehicle to demonize Israel. And the narrative, the Arab narrative, which the Western left is the inverse. So now the David and Goliath story has been inverted. Now Israel is supposed to be Goliath, right? And the Arab-Palestinians are supposed to be David. So the narrative changed. People no longer even remember that the Arab state goal of exterminating the Israeli Jews, right? They just, in the 70s, they realized. So they lost the war of 1967 also. Then they lose the war of 1973. Realize we need a new strategy. Okay, so the intentional attacks trying to exterminate the Israeli Jews You know, it's been decades. It's just not working. We're going to need, this is when they flip to the symbolic strategy. In other words, we're going to start, let's just not talk about genocide so much anymore, right? Let's not launch conventional against Israel for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
We'll calm down. And meanwhile, we will pretend that the problem is that the Arab Palestinians don't have their own state. And we will cry crocodile for the Palestinians, and we will, Western media, this was the new strategy, we're going to demonize Israel as supposedly responsible for denying our Palestinians their own state, the state that they reject, right? I mean, they rejected it. But now the argument, oh, it's the fault of the Israeli Jews. So what goes behind all this historical narrative, historians, including some traitorous Israeli historian, Morris, Nathan Weinstock, Avishle, all of these so-called new historians, right? They built this new narrative. The Israeli Jews were supposedly guilty. Tom Segev is another one. Israeli Jews were supposedly guilty atrocities during the war of 1945, injustices when the Zionist Jews were arriving from Europe into British Mandate Palestine, right? So people told, oh yeah, but you know, the Jews, and therefore the just side is the Arab Palestinians. So what we've just published on, do you have any questions about this?
Yes, I want to add something that also the historical narrative that I have in my mind a little bit in social media is well spread also, is that like the Jews, they were promised by God the land of Israel 30,000 years ago, and now like it's a gift that we want to conquer it again from the US or from the UN, that will receive it again. Like this, like a link to 30,000 years ago, but nothing in between, you know? It's like God promised you the land and it's yours. And like to secular people, it's like, just God tell you that the land is yours 3,000 years ago, and you come back and you just like kill everyone and it's yours. That's a little bit the narrative that is going on in social media right now also. Yeah.
So in other words, what you're seeing in social media is people complaining that are misusing the Bible. Right, because the Bible says that God gave you the land, but why should we believe? We don't even believe in God, right? So how why is that supposed to matter? And plus, that was a long time ago, and you weren't there. So now you just came back and you stole the land from the natives.
Yes,
right,
exactly.
So that's also part of the narrative, and what that is the fact that there's always been Jews there. The fact that they weren't running the country doesn't mean that there weren't Jews living there. There have always been Jews living there. And in fact, from the British consulate in Jerusalem from the mid-19th century, testify that the Jews were in the city of Jerusalem, not in other places, but in the city of Jerusalem, were 75% of the population of the city. They were not running it. The Arab Muslims were running it because that was the Ottoman Empire, right? And the Ottoman Empire was Muslim, and it had Turkish officials running Jerusalem and Arab officials of the Ottoman Empire running Jerusalem. So were second-class citizens because they were dhimmis, which is an official class citizen status in Muslim, but they were the majority. Okay, they were not running the city, but they were the majority. Okay, so all of that is submerged in the Arab narrative. So what we've just published, let me show people our screen. We've just published two articles. So one of them is David into Goliath, right? So what this article is tracing is of how the narrative that I still grew up with, you know, I know I don't look so old, but I was born in 1969. So when I was a kid in the 1970s, I could see that Israel was, because the transition to the new David and Goliath story had not been completed. They were beginning to do it in the 1970s, but they were just beginning. And a lot of people still admired Israel because the narrative they had in their head was this earlier David and Goliath story where the Jews are the victims, right? They get exterminated in Europe. The survivors go, then the Arabs want to exterminate them there, but they miraculously win the war. But you know, it was obvious, guys, they were the guys to support. Okay. So I remember that still, but then things started happening very quickly. There was a very quick transition into the new David and Goliath. And it was done by the leftists, because if you want to change the David and Goliath story so that the Israelis and the Arab Palestinians become the good guys, only the leftists can do this, because only they have to say who's the good guy and who's the bad guy, who's the oppressor and who's the victim. Because the entire definition, the signaling system of the left, in other words, the way to people that you are a leftist, at least a leftist in good standing, right, is by saying that you are defending victims. That's the presentation that you need in order to call this. And the presentation of leftists, they were the only ones with the right kind of prestige to transform the earlier David and Goliath story into the new David and Goliath story. So what we're seeing in this photograph is Yasser Arafat, the leader of PLO Fatah, in other words, the group that claims to represent the Arab Palestinians, right, which is a terrorist group. And next to him is Bruno Kreisky, who was the chancellor of Austria, in other words, next to Kreisky is Willy Brandt, who was chancellor of Germany. Okay, so they got together. This is a photo. All right, now this is not the only event, this is not the only strategy. The article goes into the process happened, but this event is the culmination of the process. Okay, this is once they had all their ducks in a row, that's when they had this huge event. In it was a big conference to kind of present the PLO as the new mask. forgive me, the new. Forgive me, to present the PLO as the new mascot of the international left. So Bruno Kreisky had been the president of the Socialist International, and Willy Brandt was at this point in time the president of the same international. So these two international leftists invite Yasser Arafat to this conference, and what they do in this, you know, they extol Yasser Arafat as the leader of a supposedly left, and they accuse Israel of all the problems in the Middle East. And they even compared Yasser Arafat and the PLO, they even compared their struggle against Israel to the European struggle. They did that, right? Which is what they needed to do to complete the flip. In order to complete the flip and make the Israelis odious to all left, and the PLO, the new teddy bear of the leftists, the PLO to the Jews and the Israelis to the Nazis. This is the way you flip it. That's what they did. That's what they actually
yes.
And of course, this was on the tail of many of the things that they did. I'm going to take your question. Let me.
He did.
So the author here is explaining the background, right? So what is it that might be true about what telling us for half a century now concerning the supposed injustices that the Zionist Jews brought upon the Arab Palestinians, right? And that's this here, which is called Did the Zionist Jews Take Something? And that's the topic for today. That's the title of today's podcast, right? In other words, what this article is asking is there anything that can be honestly and legitimately recruited about the history of Zionism and its interaction with the Arab Palestinians to construct this Arab narrative where the Zionist Jews and then the Israeli, the Arab Palestinians are the worthy victims. Okay. Is there something you could recruit for that? And so what I do here is I rely, oh, for some reason, this is not updated. Hold on. Here we go. I rely on this historian, Nathan Weinstock, for a very important reason. He wrote as a false messiah, as an anti-Zionist. As an anti-Zionist Marxist, okay? So he's writing from the left, and he's writing against Zionism. His book is an attempt to blame the Zionist Jews for everything. That's the mission of this book, all right? But this book, the first edition of this book, which was in French, because Nathan Weinstock is French, that first edition was published in 1969. So in 1969, the attempt to flip the Goliath narrative was just beginning. In fact, Nathan Weinstock hears of that switch. But because it was 1969, and you know, I cultural Marxism had not replaced classical Marxism yet. And classical Marxism is not about identity, it's about class, right? So Weinstock was still, he still had one foot in classical Marxism, and for that reason, he felt compelled to investigate the social relations, the class relations of the Arab-Palestinian society. And he was rather careful gathering evidence and documenting the social structure of the Arab Palestinians. He still ends up blaming the Zionists for everything, but his description of Arab Palestinian society, in fact, exonerates the Zionists, because what Weinstock documented was that even before the Zionists arrived, there was a feudal structure in So obviously the Zionists have nothing to do with that. This is a structure that already existed, that was a native structure, okay? And what was it like? Well, it was feudal, Middle Ages. So there were some, you know, a very tiny group of lower monopolizing the land, right? There were the huge landowners, and their estates were worked by slaves, Arab slaves. They couldn't leave because they had debts with the landlords. They were debt slaves. And the way this worked is that the landlords, which they needed because they were all So they would give them loans, but the loans were at interest, right? So it was, it went from 30% to 50%, sometimes as high as 80%. And so, of course, these were paid, and the fellahin, or the landless poor Arabs, became slaves. They became debt slaves, couldn't leave. The effendi, who were the landowning aristocrats, were always squeezing the fellahin. Kinds of ways of squeezing them. So it was really stark oppression, and these fellahin didn't even benefit from military protection, because if you compare feudalism, at least in the European version, the lords owed their serfs, but in British Palestine, nothing. You got nothing from them. They just oppressed you. You got nothing at all. Okay. All right. So that was the situation. What happens when the Zionists begin to arrive? The picture that most people have in their heads, because of the media campaign, the media and academic campaign that has been going on for 50 years now. Okay. So you didn't get to see this, but I saw it. I saw how they put this together. I'm that old, right? So what most people have in their heads as a result of that is the idea that the Zionist Jews arrived at the land by force, or that the British did it for them, or something like that.
Yes.
But what actually happened, and this is what Nathan Weinstock documented, great detail, even though he's attacking the Zionists, right? But he's doing historical work and he's documenting what happened. So what does he document? The Zionist Jews were actually buying land. They weren't taking land by force. Now, when you buy land, you need the person who sells the land to agree to sell it. Otherwise, you can't buy it. They have to want to sell it, right? So who were they buying land from? Well, they were buying land from Arab landowners who wanted to sell their land. So these were Arab landowners who thought, well, it's a benefit to me individually to sell my land. And why did they think the Zionists were paying a lot of money for the land? And they were buying the worst land. So they were buying desert and swamp that the Arab landlord, it was mostly desert and swamp that was mostly unproductive. It was very difficult for the fellahin to make these lands produce for the Arab landowners. So the Arab landowners thought, great, you know, these Zionist Jews, they my worst land, and they're paying a lot of money for it. Well, complete these transactions. So a lot of land changed hands in this way. Of course, the as it's famous, the Zionist Jews improved the land and they made it very productive. But when they bought it, it was terrible land. Lords didn't even want. Okay. Now, the argument has been made that the Arab-Palestinian problem stems from the fact that in these land acquisitions, the fellahin were evicted. So the problem of lots of landless peasants as a result of these. But what Weinstock documented, of the evictions happened when Arabs were buying and selling land between Arabs. Okay? So the Zionists were not doing this. They were not expelling the poor Arabs from the land. What was happening was that some Arabs were buying lands from other Arabs. Okay? And when they did this, they would kick the slaves out. They would kick them out. And then they consolidate the plots and sell the land to the... Now, the whole thing was a racket because what some of the big Arab landlords is that they were going to, and this is all in the Weinstock evidence. So they were going to the... So most people didn't have land. 70% of the population were fellahin, who didn't have land at all. But there were some poor peasants who did have title to their tiny plots of land. Okay? So most of the land was owned by the big landowners, but there were a few Arabs who were relatively poor who had plots of land that they did have title to. Right? Now, those relatively poor Arabs who had title to small pieces of land to the Zionists because they were poor and the Zionists were paying. So this was the way to get out of poverty. Okay. The arrival of the Zionists was a benefit to anybody who had a little bit of land because you would very quickly, and most of these people were very poor. Right. So the smallholders wanted to sell. But what did the big Arab landowners do? The big Arab landowners were financing, and so the terrorists of hired by these landowners would go to the smallholders, the people who had tiny plots of land, and they would tell them, if you dare sell your land to the Zionist Jews, we will kill you and we will kill your entire family. You're a traitor, I would say. Okay? So they would pretend to be Arab Palestinian national, right? Something like that. They were supposedly protecting the land from falling into the hands of the Jews, right? This was the public narrative. And so they would go to the smallholders and threaten them, and they would say, "If you dare sell your land to the Zionist Jews, we will come and we will kill you. We will kill your whole family. You know what? If you want, we will buy it. We will sell your land, we will buy it." And so they would put it onto their head, right? And they would buy the land for almost nothing. And they would consolidate those plots of land, consolidate the plots of land, and then they would they would sell it to the Zionist Jews for extortionate prices, for very high prices. So the Arab Palestinian movement was in fact a racket. It was a criminal racket, so that these Arab landowners could continue to squeeze more benefit from these Arab poor, right, and get a lot of money from the Zionist Jews. All of this is documented by Nathan Weinstock. And so what emerges from his documentation, there was no real Arab-Palestinian, no such thing. They weren't defending the country. They weren't defending the land. They weren't speaking for a nation. There was nothing like that. It was just the traditional oppressive structure of Palestinians developing a new strategy for oppressing them. Okay, they were taking advantage of a new opportunity to. Now, you can't say that the Zionist Jews were hurting the Arab aristocrats because they were making them very, very, very rich. Okay, so there is no argument to be made that the Zionist Jews were hurting the lords in any way, those being very rich. What about the fellahin? You could make the argument, and the argument has been made, that the evicted from the land and they became jobless and landless, that this was the fault of the process, at least, that if the Zionist Jews had not arrived and hadn't started buying all that land, the poor among the Arab Palestinians would not have ended up in such problems. you know. But what Weinstock documents is, as I said, that most of the land sales between Arabs, but not the the slaves who were evicted were finding jobs in the Zionist Jews, because the Zionist Jews created a booming economy in British Palestine. So in fact, the Jews on the poor was liberate them from slavery and give them jobs, slave. Okay? And and the booming Zionist economy absorbed not only those evicted slaves, but also thousands and thousands and thousands of Arabs came from different places to find to life in the booming economy. So many Arabs were coming in illegally, by the way, illegally into Britain, that more Arabs entered than Jews. So the British were supposedly administering British Palestine because they were going to create a Jewish homeland there, right? That was supposed to be the official reason that the League of Nations had given them control of that area. But more Arabs came in than Jews. And all that came in, plus slaves, all of them found jobs in the economy that the Jews produced. So there is no sense in which the Zionist Jews, the Arab Palestinians. It's a lie. And the refutation of the lie is even in Nathan Weinstock's book, Damn the Jews. It was written to make the argument that that all of the problems of the Arab Palestinians were the fault of the Zionist Jews. So this is the so check out the historical sequence. The historical sequence is that the Zionist Jews arrive, they benefit the upper classes, they make them very rich because they buy the they buy their land. They benefit the lower classes because they're emancipating the Fellahin from slavery and giving them jobs in a booming economy. They didn't steal land from anyone. And then 1947 arrives, and the UN doesn't say, well, we're going to make a Jewish state here in British Band of Palestine. No, they said, we're going to make two states. Two states. And the Arab Palestinians said, no, we don't want an Arab Palestinian state. Well, I shouldn't say the Arab Palestinians. The so-called leadership of the Arab Palestinians said this, right? The guy who had all the power was Haj Amin al-Hussein, okay? And I have to give you a little context, because Weinstock documents that, well, Haj Amin al-Husseini was the leading representative of the most important Arab-Palestinian family. This was the biggest landowning family. So the biggest feudal lords of Arab Palestine, right, were the Husseinis, okay? And Haj Amin al-Husseini was the leader of the family. He was the Mufti of Jerusalem. The British made him Mufti of Jerusalem, so he had a lot of power. And he was the guy organizing the terrorist gangs to terrorize the smallholders among the Arabs so that they wouldn't sell to the Zionist Jews. And a cousin of Husseini was running that racket, even as Husseini pretended to be leading a national Arab movement against the Zionist Jews. Okay, it was, the whole thing was hypocritical. So this same Husseini in 1947 was the guy who said, no, we don't want an Arab-Palestinian state. The leader of the Arab-Palestinian national movement said, we don't want an Arab-Palestinian state. What we want is for the Jews to have nothing. And Azam Pasha of the Arab League announced that they would exterminate the Zionist Jews. So this was the position of the Arab-Palestinian movement. In spite of the fact that the Zionist Jews had been benefiting them, and in spite of the fact that in 1947, they were offered an Arab state alongside the Jewish state, right? two-state solution, they said no.
Hmm.
Okay? They said no. So that's the historical sequence. The Zionist Jews arrive. They benefit the Arab Palestinians. The leader of the Arab Palestinian, quote-unquote, national movement is terrorizing the Arabs and making a killing with a criminal racket from sales to the Zionist Jews, right? So he and the other aristocrats are also benefiting. There's a booming economy. Everybody's livelihood improves. Thousands of Arab immigrants are absorbed. And then the UN gives them a state. After all those benefits, the UN gives them a state. A state that is going to be economically way better than what they used to have because the Zionists have improved the whole area, right? And what do they say? No, we don't want a state. We want to exterminate the Israeli Jews. And this is something that none of these Gen Zers who are shouting free Palestine in the streets and down with Israel, death to Israel, et cetera, they don't know any of this. And all of it, absolutely all of it is documented in Nathan Weinstock's book. Not only that, Nathan Weinstock also documents that the Arab Palestinian National Movement, as he insists in calling it, was a racist movement. So let me give you the quote from Weinstock. I'm going to put it up on the screen because it's amazing. It's amazing. Look at this. He says, the Palestinian anti-colonialist movement, the Jews into colonialists, right? Mm-hmm. Says the Palestinian anti-colonialist movement was deformed by racism. Deformed by racism because he doesn't want to say they were just a bunch of racists, which they were, right? He says the distorted national struggle expressed itself in anti-Jewish slogans such as Palestine is our country and the Jews are our dogs, followed up by attacks upon Jewish passersby, like we're seeing today all over the West, right? There's a Jew walking by and people think they can attack him or her because of something that is supposedly happening in the Middle East, right? So these guys were acting like this. The Jews were walking by and they would attack them. They would attack Jewish passersby and store owners, and eventually mob violence akin to the all too familiar pogrom. So a pogrom is a word that comes from Tsarist Russia, and what it means is an unprovoked attack by the general population against the Jews. That's what it means, okay? So this is what was going on. They were attacking ordinary people. They were not defending a country. They were just attacking Jews. And by the way, the attacks were not only against Zionist Jews, but also against the Jews who had always lived there, who had always been part of the land. Sometimes the attacks were exclusively against them. So it was simply racism, okay? Racism. And Weinstock has to recognize it, because he's a historian and he's documenting with facts what happened. So he can't, he at least in 1969, the idea of these historians who will just invent history, you know, the historians, as they call them, who just make stuff up. Nobody was that bold yet in 1969, felt obligated to you know, document with facts what had happened. He still tries to put an anti-Zionist interpretation on all of it, but needed to report the facts. And one of those facts is that the Arab-Palestinian National Movement was not really a national movement. It was just a racist movement. And that makes sense. It makes sense because Haj Amin al-Husseini was the guy leading that movement. And we know that Haj Amin al-Husseini, consummate racist. Going to share my screen again. We know Amin al-Husseini was actually directing the death camp system in Europe during the German. Okay, so we have the article right here. This is the most popular art of reality, at least if you measure it by likes. And documents, this is Haji Amin al-Husseini right here, shaking the hands of the Nazis. That's when he arrived in Berlin in 1941. After leaving British Palestine, he goes to Berlin. Well, he goes to Iraq, where he organizes the Farhud, which was a pogrom against the Jews of Baghdad, and pretty much ends Jewish life in Iraq. And then he goes to Berlin, where they receive him as if he was some kind of head of state, you know, an international leader of Muslims, which he was. And he was not a head of state, but he was an international leader of the Muslims. And he becomes a top Nazi official, becomes best friends with Adolf Eichmann. And together with Eichmann, they administer the entire system of death camps that murdered the European Jewish people. So Husseini was clearly a racist, and Husseini was the leader of the so-called Arab-Palestinian National Movement. Therefore, of course, that movement was racist. Of course, what Weinstock documented makes sense. Right?
Okay.
But this is the story. This is the story that young people like yourself today don't know, because it's been erased from media and academia.
This is a real surprise for me, because I didn't know about that. And what I see here is, Francisco, that it repeats itself. Like, the own leaders of the Arab-Palestinian movement, right, they were the oppressors of their own people, claiming to be the good ones. The Jewish people came, they freed themselves, the poor people, and are the leaders, they stopped the Jewish people from liberating them. They say no to a two-state solution. And that's the same what's happening now with Gaza also. Like, it's same the same thing. Like, if Israel would win the war against Hamas and destroy them absolutely, they would liberate again all the Palestinian people who are being oppressed, who the people are still by Hamas when they came the tract of Israel. They are liberating them, that, like, so it repeats itself. I can see that that cycle. So it's...
Yes, that's a very sharp observation. When the Zionists were arriving in British Palestine, the thing people don't understand is that the Zionist Jews had a pro-Arab ideology. Their ideology was pro-Arab. They believed, because they were socialists, so their ideology was, we need to create links of solidarity with the Arab poor. We need to be friends with the Arab poor. We need to give them jobs. We shouldn't expel them from the land. And they did give them jobs. Whenever the Zionist Jews bought a plot of land where the Arab fellahin had not been evicted, they hired them as workers. Their entire philosophy was to help the Arabs. Whereas the philosophy of the Arab landowners was to oppress the Arabs. So the only friends the Arab poor had were the Zionist Jews. And this was relatively the Arab poor back then. You know, and that's why Haji Amin al-Husseini had to direct terrorism against any Arabs who began fracking. He didn't want the Arabs to become friends with the Jews, you see, and to get socialist Jews and you know, get the notion that maybe they can be free, you know, society can be different. They didn't want that. If any Arabs began fracking Jews, Husseini would send his terrorists to kill them. Husseini, in fact, killed one of his own cousins, being friends with the Zionist Jews.
Wow.
That's how worried they were. Ideological contamination. Your observation is right on point. the Zionist Jews were nothing but a blessing for all of them, even the rich ones. They were making them rich, richer, right? But the Arab bosses were only interested in oppressing the poor, the Arab poor. And you're right, the same thing is going on right now. So the IDF has made huge efforts to Palestinian civilians. We've said this many times. When they're going to do a military operation, they make, you know, thousands of phone calls, send millions of emails, drop millions of leaflets, explain to people where the operation is going to be so that they can move, destroy their own element of surprise, which puts Israeli soldiers at risk. Because they're trying to spare Arab civilian lives. The enemy terrorist organization, they threaten the Arab Palestinians so that they will return to the structures that the Israelis have said that they're going to destroy. Because they want the Arab Palestinians to die there so that the media, pro-Arab, the Western media, well, they're not pro-Arab, they're anti-Arab, they're pro-Hamas, right? So the pro-Hamas media in the West will use those Arab deaths against Israel, right? They'll blame Israel for the Arab civilian deaths try to prevent and that Hamas ensured would happen, right? Blame them for supposedly cutting the humanitarian aid, which they haven't done, for causing hunger, which they haven't caused, and so on and so forth, right? This is so you have once again the Jews trying to protect the Arab poor while the Arab bosses are oppressing the Arab poor. Okay. Now I want to tell you a story that you're going to find very interesting, which is about the cultural aspect of the switch from Goliath story to the new David and Goliath story. And I'll share my screen again to tell you where this is. So this is in the David into Goliath article, okay? So the cultural part of this switch was done via this guy, Edward Said, okay? Edward Said was a card-carrying member, hello. And he was also a Columbia University literature professor, okay? He was Egyptian. He was not Palestinian. But he pretended to be Palestinian, okay? And the media pretended that he was Palestinian. So he became the famous Palestinian professor at Columbia, okay? And he wrote two very important books, very influential books. I had them on the screen right here. So one of them is Orientalism. And the other is The Question of Palestine, okay? And via those two books, because the media turned him into a rock star, okay? So right after he published Orientalism, the New York Times said, this guy is a genius. And pretty soon, Edward Said was publishing his own editorials in the New York Times. Right. So there was a huge campaign to convince people that Edward Said was God's gift to the world. Such a genius who really understood, you know, the Orient and Arab society and the West and colonialism and the Arab-Israeli conflict. You know, he was supposed to understand everything. So they turned him into the cultural arbiter. Right. Professors who teach in the humanities and the social sciences in all the elite universities of the West, they turned Edward Said into required reading. I had to read.
Wow.
You know, it was required. Yeah. I studied anthropology. Of course you had to read Edward Said. So by doing this, by turning Edward Said into this academic and media rock star, generations of university students were convinced that Israel is the bad guy and that the Arab Palestinians are the good guys. Because if that's not the case, why are all my professors making me read Edward Said? It must be because he's good, he's smart, he's morally right, right? That must be the reason. That must be the reason. Why is everybody making me read him? They were reading a PLO terrorist. Edward Said was a card-carrying member of the PLO, okay? A member of the Palestinian National Council.
Wow.
He was the guy that the PLO called to mediate between different PLO factions when they couldn't get along. That's how important he was in the PLO, okay? And this is the guy that all of the media turned into a rock star so that everybody would think that the Arab Palestinians were the good guys and that the PLO was kosher. And it succeeded. It succeeded. Now, one of the reasons it succeeded is that there was this culture in the 1970s that what's his name? Tom Wolfe explained beautifully. Okay. So Tom Wolfe was this, he was a journalist and a novelist, and he was a really, really, really good journalist because Tom Wolfe was at heart, he was an ethnographer. He was a social anthropologist at heart. He didn't have a degree in social anthropology, but he was really a natural anthropologist. So he paid very good attention to all kinds of signals and signs and symptoms of the culture. And he could diagnose it very precisely. And he wrote this book, which is called Radical Chic. Radical Chic refers to how the left in the 1970s became enamored of terrorists. Okay, so the left in the 1970s learned to think of the terrorist fighting, Western governments, Western colonial governments, whatever. If they were fighting colonialism, then they were the good guys, even if they were terrorists. Okay. This is what Tom Wolfe is calling radical chic. And in this book is a very famous scene where Philharmonic conductor Leonard Bernstein organizes a fundraiser for the Black Panthers in his New York, in his very, very upscale New York apartment in Park Avenue. Okay, now, for young people who don't know what the Black Panthers are, they were a group of Black in the United States that justice and the PLO terrorists were oppressing their own people, oppressing Blacks, because they had a whole racket where they would extort money from people who had businesses in Black neighborhoods. They, at the point of a gun, they would extort money from people who owned businesses there. They would use the money for, among other things, terrorist activities. Okay? And the official narrative is that they were battling, not Jim Crow anymore because it had just been abolished, but that they were battling systemic racism, what we now call systemic racism. Mm. The Black Panthers were and they wanted juridical independence for Blacks in the United States. That's what they were, that's what they said that they were fighting for. And they were very exciting to the upper class whites in the 70s who wanted to prove by supporting the Black Panthers that they were, they were revolutionaries too. They were radicals too. They were fighting the good fight for the people against the man. They wanted to have that kind of cachet. So the conductor, Leonard Bernstein, he organized fundraiser for the Black Panthers in his own apartment. And the scene was described by Tom Wolfe. It was a ridiculous scene with all these high society white people trying to get redeemed by the Black Panthers. Like, if the Black me, because I'm fundraising money for the, you know, I'll be a person. That this whole phenomenon that is still going on with white people on the left, woke, now we call this woke, you know, trying to get redeemed by minorities who will forgive them past sins of whites, you know, if they support their system, right? That whole thing started in the late 90s, and that's what Tom Wolfe was making fun of in Radical Chic. Okay, well, Edward was part of this phenomenon. So the reason he was so exciting to all of these left professors in the universities and to the that wanted to be able to say that they were good leftists, he was a Palestinian terrorist. So he was the Palestinian terror professor. So that was exciting. That was like, oh, you know, he's fighting revolution. This made him someone to admire in this crazy logic of the new cultural Marxist left, which didn't see the thing about cultural Marxism is straight identity politics. It's no longer class-based Marxism. You're no longer defending the poor against the rich oppressors. You're defending brown people against white people. It's all about race. Mm. It's a racist left. You see, it's a racist left. Once you make the left racist, the behavior of the people you're defending no longer matters. The only thing that matters is the color of their skin. So if they're racist, who cares? They're brown, they're black, they're and then they invented these other categories. They're trans, they're whatever. So long, sexuals, right? They're the good guys. It doesn't matter how they behave. It doesn't matter what they do. It doesn't matter what they believe. The entire model is racist. Okay.
Yes.
This wagon that made Edward Said into a prominent figure, and by making him into a prominent figure, young college students were conditioned that the Arab Palestinians are the good guys, the big bad guys, and this is how the David versus Goliath narrative was inverted. And we're still living in this management of reality. We're still in this managed reality, trying to produce the next. And so if the people listening to us would like to contribute their grain of sand, knowledge more widely, and thereby, you know, making their own effort to impeding the next anti-Jewish genocide, which is going to be very costly, not just but for all Westerners, because anti-Jewish genocides are by the slavery of everybody else. So help fight against that. Please like the video, subscribe, and share it everywhere, because we need to make this knowledge much more widely known so that Westerners to the manipulation that they've been subjected to is designed to the cultural Marxist left, the identity politics, the woke. It's designed to make us enemies of each other, designed to fracture all tribes that are all enemies of each other, where everybody's always trying to decide this so that they can wreak vengeance on them. That's going to destroy us. We were on a better path. The path we were on was the path civil rights movement, which says the color of your skin should never matter. The only thing that should matter is the quality of your character, the things you actually do in the world. That's what should matter, not the color of your skin, not your sexual orientation. Why are we fighting about these things? We should all be united in the effort for free West, and keeping a free West means fighting against the jihadis who want to destroy it. Sure. Keeping a free West does not mean making an alliance with the jihadis against the Israeli Jews. That's Israeli Jews are the ones defending the entire West. Israeli soldiers are doing us the favor, fighting the forces of jihad for the entire. So let's give them a hand. Let's share this knowledge, which defends the state of Israel, defends the Jews best. Let's share and subscribe. Please share. Please like us. Ding the bell. Unless Yoel has a fight,
we yes, can leave it. I would like to add two things. Also, if like share it, like it, and we also have this new website here. I wanna share it. If you wanna donate to us, money, whatever you want, if you know someone who can donate, here in managementofreality.com, you go here down to donations, and here we have in Mexican pesos, in Spanish.
Show them how to do it in dollars. Show them how to do
here,
it.
Here, you press here in English, and you have in dollars. So whatever you may want to donate, it's more than welcome to us. So thank you so much, whatever your contribution could be. Okay, so that's...
Excellent. I'm so glad you remembered that.
Yeah.
Yeah, give us money. Here's a way to help.
Yeah, like whatever you can, maybe time, maybe you can share it, contacts or money, whatever your source could be, it's very helpful for us. So yeah, that's one thing. The other thing that I want to add, I think it's really important, is that even this this person is Watson, what's the Winston? This man, the historian.
Oh, Weinstock, the historian.
Sorry, Weinstock. Okay, so
Weinstock.
So even this man, who seems really smart, a historian who puts like many facts in order and publishes this book, and he does everything right. He's not making this up. He's really believing, I believe, in what he's writing.
Well, his historic very very good. It is widely recognized, very good. But his interpretation is crazy. He blames the Zionist Jews, even though his own documentation shows that they were a huge benefit to the Arab Palestinians.
Okay, so that's what I mean. Like, if the hypothesis is that he believes what he's saying and he's not like lying, that means that the mindset of humans is very interesting, right? Because when you have an preconceived idea, it doesn't matter what are the arguments, what are the documents, what do you see with your own eyes, what can you hear? It doesn't matter. You will be in the same position and in the same direction, no matter what the truth is, right? Like, everything will be adjustable and everything will be like to your ideas, right? Like would be interpreted with your own ideas.
Right. Don't confuse me with the facts. It's made up, right? This is what happened
exactly. To a lot of people. So we need to be very careful with that.
Right. So we at Management of Reality are committed to facts. That's our mission for today, everybody. Thank you for joining Management of Reality. I'll see you on Monday, same time, for our weekly English podcast. Stay
Thank you so much.
True to the West. Do your part.
Thank